against a domestic terrorist and the hate that filled him. There's an important lesson in this. In many parts of society today, whether in popular culture, academia, the media, or politics, there's a tendency to falsely equate noise with results. Some people think that you have to be the loudest voice in the room to make a difference. That's just not true. Often the best thing we can do is turn down the volume. When the sound is quieter, you can actually hear what someone else is saying. And that can make a world of difference. Of course, that doesn't mean we won't have strong disagreements. We will. And as we usher in this new era, Republicans will stand up for our beliefs. If we held the White House, taxes would be lower for working families, and we'd put the brakes on runaway spending and debt. We would encourage American innovation and success instead of demonizing them. So our economy would truly soar and good jobs would be available across our country. We would reform education so it worked best for students, parents, and teachers, not Washington bureaucrats and union bosses. We would end a disastrous health care program and replace it with reforms that lowered costs and actually let you keep your doctor. We would respect differences in modern families, but we would also insist on respect for religious liberty as a cornerstone of our democracy. We would recognize the importance of the separation of powers and honor the Constitution in its entirety. And yes, that includes the Second and Tenth Amendments. We would make international agreements that were celebrated in Israel and protested in Iran, not the other way around. And rather than just thanking our brave men and women in uniform, we would actually strengthen our military so both our friends and our enemies would know that America seeks peace. But when we fight wars, we win them. We have big decisions to make. Our country is being tested, but we've been tested in the past, and our people have always risen to the challenge. We have all the guidance we need to be safe and successful. Our forefathers paved the way for us. Let's take their values and their strengths and rededicate ourselves to doing whatever it takes to keep America the greatest country in the history of man and woman. Thank you, good night, and God bless.
And of course, that was the official GOP reaction from South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. But before we get to reaction to her response to the GOP reaction, let's take a look at what folks are saying out there on the social media. Obviously, the social media has been abuzz with all sorts of reaction from a lot of the candidates. Mariama Diallo has been following that for us and has some of the tweets that have been coming out there. What are they saying, Mariama?
Well, Mel, to give you an idea of how many tweets pop up, literally a minute when you put the hashtag SOTOU, it's in the hundreds. You read one tweet, and by the time you have time to look at another tweet, it's like hundreds of tweets. So a huge number definitely took to social media and Twitter in particular. And for reactions, we'll go first, we'll look at quick ones. We can't read all of them, obviously, but I'll open with Hillary Clinton, who wrote that POTUS is right. Progress isn't inevitable. We have a choice between pushing forward or undoing all the work that we've done. I'll move move on to a tweet from Ben Carson on the other side, saying that Obama thinks that education should be controlled by the federal government. I believe we must take the Fed out of education. We must. That's a tweet from Ben Carson, Republican presidential candidate, and another candidate, Republican presidential candidate, Jeb Bush, tweeted this, that middle-class income has declined under $2,000 under Obama. Obama's failed policies, that's not progress, he says. That's not giving everyone a fair shot. And finally, one more tweet from one of the presidential candidates, this time a Democrat, and it's Martin O'Malley, who wrote that Daesh indeed does not represent a great world religion. We can't give in to fear and allow divisive voices to scapegoat American Muslims. So that's a few reactions on the official side.
Mariama, right. I want to touch a little bit about the social media reaction towards Governor Haley's response. What I make out of the response is that it's a very balanced, a very sympathetic response, very much toning down the rhetoric of doom and gloom that perhaps we've been hearing from the Republican candidates. Are we seeing that kind of reaction as well on social media?
Well, I think reactions are still coming in, and I think I've seen actually one very positive reaction from a person who wrote that just basically after listening to Governor Haley's two minutes into Governor Haley's speech, and the person said that that's better than the past 7 or 8 years of the State of the Union speeches. But the other things that we're getting are also more general kind of comments about speeches, and I'll go through some of them this time. Ben Needham, I think he writes that economic recovery, healthcare, I guess he's talking about POTUS this time, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, saying that economic recovery, healthcare, energy, ending the wars and gay marriage, not a bad record, Mr. President. Another one talks about what a monumental two terms it has been, from accessible healthcare to freedom to marry. And before I get to the critics, I'll do just one more tweet on the Obama reactions, talking about that the GOP refuses to applaud America digging out from the Bush recession. Wow. But not everything was positive, critics, and I'll go to one who said that we have made a lot of progress, and this is Robert Kuipers, I think, but we need to make more. And another one says, yes, yes, you have reshaped the way we live and work, and I guess it's talking about President Obama, but making it harder. Thanks. I wanted also to point out that the State of the Union is not always about politics. And this tweet, for example, show that people are interested in many different aspects of and many different topics of this State of the Union. And this one talks about the First Lady's dress, saying that she is the definition of grace. All hail our First Lady. Well, I love orange. It's my favorite color, so I might be a little biased. But I'll leave it to you guys, Mill and Patsy.
Thank you, Mariama. Now let's bring back our panelists here. Let me reintroduce them again. We have Elizabeth Senna, Vice President at Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. We have Matt Gammon, Vice President at Wilson Perkins Allen Research. For an international perspective, we are also joined by Dr. Lorenzo Vedino, Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Welcome again, our guests. You just heard the GOP reaction. There was no thirsty water bottle moments there. Generally, the reaction has been quite positive. I must say that that Nikki Haley said that, unfortunately, a president's record has fallen far short of his soaring words. However, she also laid some criticism at some of the candidates there. I'll start with you, Elizabeth. First of all, what were your thoughts on the appropriateness of Nikki Haley's response to the president's address? Did you like what she had to say? Was it balanced?
Yeah, you know, I think they were as expected. You know, given we're in a presidential cycle and there's a lot of Republican candidates running, they needed somebody that would be calm and collected and deliver sort of a red meat Republican response, which is what we saw when she hit on things like cutting taxes and addressing runaway spending. I mean, those are sort of key Republican buzzwords. I can tell you from a polling perspective, runaway spending, cutting it, it tests very well because nobody wants runaway spending. But I think the other things we should really look at that she mentioned, where she hit on the divisiveness as well that we're seeing in politics, mm-hmm. and sort of called that out. She also called out some of the Republican presidential candidates and, you know, not turning towards anger. And I think she sort of tried to temper that down, hitting on the fact that she was an immigrant and sort of telling her part of the story, trying to show that the Republican Party is more than what we're seeing with Trump and attacking Muslims and being very closed-minded and sort of opening that up. So she really was, as Matt had mentioned previously, a great Republican individual to try to give a different face on the Republican Party, which we've expected to be, you know, old, white, and male.
Okay. Yeah, Jim, absolutely.
I think we're seeing a rehearsal here for the election, because we saw the president lay out a certain economic record. Right away, Nikki Haley went at the flat wages, which is a problem. The Democrats will emphasize job growth. The Republicans will say, well, a lot of people still are looking for work. The jobs aren't that great. So there's going to be a lot of divisiveness on that. Nikki Haley also said the president just doesn't seem to understand the terrorism threat at the moment. So we have, on one hand, President Obama giving his version of how we deal with the threat from Islamic State, and a completely different view from the Republicans. And that is playing out on the campaign trail. I really do see, with all the references that President Obama made to some of the rhetoric in the campaign, and indirectly Donald Trump, we actually are talking a lot about Donald Trump tonight. And it wasn't just President Obama. Nikki Haley also said you have to watch in those times of tension when the voices of fear and anger. So it's had a huge impact. And I also think so much of the president's speech, he wants to be in this game. He wants to be part of the discussion for 2016. It's his record. It's his legacy. He's not out of there for another year. He wants to have a say in this. Whether or not the voters are that interested to hear him, especially on the Republican side, that's a debatable question.
One thing that really struck me about the response, the GOP response, was the fact that she actually said that the Republicans have to own up to this divisiveness that is wracking the country right now. She said, we need to recognize our contribution to the erosion of the public trust in American government. And I don't really remember any past GOP response of being that direct or being that open.
It was interesting that she at least made that that point, that it's not all one party's fault. But certainly the rhetoric we're hearing on the campaign trail is trying to lay a lot of the responsibility at Barack Obama's doorstep, and I don't think that's going to end after tonight.
Matt Gani, your thoughts on that? Should Republican candidates take more of the blame for the divisiveness and for some of the issues?
Or
that
even
are,
just tone down the rhetoric.
Yeah.
Well, I think that she did a great job of helping us kind of bridge some of the identity politics and the divisive rhetoric that has sprung up over the last 7 years and sort of presenting a future forward for America. And I think part of what you're seeing on the campaign trail is another response to the last 7 years and the identity politics and the some of the racial divide and the inequality that we've seen crop up when you have large segments of the American public that feel they are being left behind or that feel that their needs are not being heard by their leaders in Washington. And I think that there's, you know, the path in 2016 is going to be bridging some of these very justifiable concerns that leadership in Washington is not responsive to the concerns of average Americans that you see, you know, not only in the Republican side with Donald Trump and some others, but also on the Democratic side fueling Bernie Sanders' campaign. I think it's a, you know, the anger against D.C. Is a bipartisan issue, quite frankly.
I want to go to Dr. Vedino right now. One thing that was not discussed very much, just very mentioned in passing in the State of the Union speech, was the issue of gun control. Now, for many of our international audience, this is the one thing that baffles people the most. When you look at the statistics, almost 90 people a day deaths from gun control. The number of guns, 310 million, almost the same number of populations in the USA. What do you make of the fact that this was not mentioned very much in the speech, perhaps only just in passing?
It is, to be honest, quite surprising because we all know how much the president has talked about it. We saw the emotional speech that he gave just a few days ago about gun control. So I think it was quite surprising that he didn't mention it in the State of the Union. Obviously, there were other parts where he tried to unite the country. He touched only a few issues that are divisive. We know how divisive gun control is. But indeed, from an international perspective, I think that is one of the most puzzling issues about American politics and American society, the gun control issue, whether it has the day-to-day implications in gangs, schools, or the terrorism side of things. It is an issue that the whole world sort of asks questions about.
And let's bring Michael Bowman back into this conversation. Michael Bowman, what else are you hearing in terms of reaction to Governor Nikki Haley's speech and what the president just said? What more do you have at this stage?
Well, let me just say that as the Senate correspondent, I am struck something from President Obama's speech and something that we heard from Nikki Haley as well. And that is lamenting the partisan nature of our politics and the destructive nature of American politics. I speak with senators all the time, and they lament to me all the time how much they would love to get things done, how much they would love to reach across the aisle, how much they detest some of the political scrapes in which they find themselves. And then a day or two later, I see them go on the Senate floor and stick the knife into each other. President Obama addressed this. I don't know to what extent one single presidential speech is going to make a difference on this. But I was struck by something else as well, if you'll just if you'll allow me, and that is the need of both President Obama and of Governor Haley to throw down the gauntlet on an ideological basis, while also sort of appealing to America's better angels. And Jim spoke about Donald Trump. It was striking the extent to which both President Obama and Governor Haley, in a sense, took digs at Donald Trump.
Elizabeth, go ahead.
Just broaden it out for our guests, because if you watch the end of the president's speech, and he said this was the most important point he wanted to make, which was about our politics. How do we fix our politics? This is a president who spent 7 years with some successes, some failures, dealing with a Congress with the same record, again, failures and successes. And it comes back to this. This has been a problem in this country for a few decades now, this growing polarization, political polarization, not getting something done, ideologically camps dug in. And I wonder for our political guests, I mean, is this something that can be fixed? Are we, especially in election year, is it pie in the sky?
Elizabeth Sennett, let's start with you. Whose fault is it that we can't get anything done in this country when it comes to congressional laws on gun control, on immigration, any host of issues? Why can't we get anything done? Whose fault is that?
That's a pretty loaded question there. So I think part of the issue is the system that's in play, and I think President Obama really touched on this. You know, one of the things he sort of alluded to but didn't use the word was gerrymandering, and when we talk about redistricting. And you know, you have seats that are remarkably safe, so for the international audience here, when they get redistricted and they get drawn, and he mentioned you know, the representatives get to choose their voters, and it's a case where either a Republican or a Democrat, you can't lose the seat. It's just so partisan. And then this sort of enables you know, Congress to become more and more divisive. And as we look forward to 2020 and redistricting, I mean, that's something very much, I think, to keep in mind with the political system. The other thing the president touched on was also money in politics. And, you know, more with these, with PACs that are rising up, sort of independent spending, you know, on either side, both Democrats and Republicans, you have very wealthy individuals, more so on the Republican side, who band together to have PACs to support the different candidates. We've seen on the Democratic side, you have individuals who take sort of their independent effort. So I'm thinking of NextGen, an environmental led by a billionaire Steyer. So, you know, money is making the sort of situation worse and more polarized. So that's something else that could be addressed. But it's a difficult situation, and these are very large challenges, and it's not an easy situation.
Matt Gaetti, the Pandora is out of the box already. I mean, can you ever get rid of money from politics? Is there any way to do that now that we've gotten into these giant super PACs and Citizens United rulings? Is there anything that we can do now?
It's a great question, but I'm not sure that it's something that we would even want to do if we could. I mean, money is a form of speech, as the Supreme Court has said, and if you didn't have money in politics, you'd have somebody else making decisions, probably somebody who's not as responsive to the public. You know, in our system, money is one of the ways that people are able to get their voices heard, to get on TV, to get access to, you know, different things. And it's not just money that we hear through, you know, wealthy donors. There are large union contributions. There are large corporate contributions. I mean, lots of different factions in the American political system have taken advantage of different types of access, of which money is only one. And it speaks to the larger problems that Elizabeth was mentioning in terms of systemic challenges and systemic issues that we as a country have that have led to the situation Jim's talking about, where we have increased, you know, bipartisan, a lack of cooperation there. And One of the things that I think is going to be extremely challenging beyond just the simple gerrymandering is that people are getting their information from so many different sources now. It's very easy to obtain polarized information, and that increasingly means that the world that we talk about has different facts around it, and these different facts are what people in these gerrymandered districts are responding to. It's increasingly difficult here at the end of 8 years of Obama, not saying it's totally his fault, to have conversations between the left and the right that sometimes even have the same set of facts that you're talking about. So information is going to be one of the other things we need to get a handle on.
Dr. Vedino, all these different sets of facts, is it making our country less safe?
Well, obviously, I think the conversation tonight wasn't really about national security, but I think the divisions do play out also in the national security field. I mean, the Republican response did touch on some pretty strong criticism that the Republicans have had on national security. I think Governor Haley called the president either unwilling or unable to deal with the threat of ISIS. That's a pretty strong accusation. She touched upon the issue of Iran and the Iran deal being celebrated in Iran but opposed in Israel. She touched upon the issue of refugees, which the president didn't really touch, which is also very divisive. These are core issues over which you see a big gap, big divide between Democrats and Republicans, and have strong national security implications.
And that is, I guess, the point I was trying to get at, is this whole fear-mongering that revolves around Syrian refugees, for example, and immigration. Those are kinds of issues that we can't seem to get the right answers for. Is it dangerous for our country to actually allow refugees in? I mean, how much of a danger does that pose? I think many studies will suggest probably that it's a very small percentage that is actually true there. But what are your thoughts on the security dangers of allowing refugees into this country?
I think you said it correctly. Statistically, the danger is minimal. We have seen, for example, of the 80 individuals who have been charged for ISIS-related activities in the U.S. since 2014, only three of them have a refugee background. Two of them happened last week, to be honest. One was in California and one was in Texas. So obviously, statistically, you're going to have some statistically insignificant numbers, but they do exist. I think we saw both the president and the Republican response were very balanced in a way, even though they had a different sort of policy solution, they were very balanced in sort of rejecting the politics of fear and fear-mongering that has come from some quarters during the campaign. Even you know, the Republican response was pretty strong in that, and obviously that's something that the mainstream of American policy is trying to reject. The facts are there. As I said, it's isolated cases. Obviously, the debate is there on how much you can vet refugees, and I think the FBI itself has gone on the record saying that it's, at the end of the day, not always possible to really vet people. So it's a very complicated issue, but I think that the rhetoric needs to be toned down a bit on that.
And you want to add something to that, Jim?
Well, I just want to say that we've heard tonight how it's an untraditional State of the Union. There wasn't a list of proposals. We're not going to see the president. We did talk. He did talk about a war on cancer, effectively, mm-hmm. with Vice President Biden.
The new moonshot. Yes.
Yeah, but you know, it's all well and good. I wonder what the American voters are going to take away from this. Those who watched.
Yeah.
You know. Okay. So where do you want to go now? What do you want to do? He laid out a nice general theme of what he thought his presidency has been about, where he'd like it to go, and what the lasting effects for the future he'd like to see. But, you know, sometimes people need a little meat. I just wonder if, you know, what's the rallying point now, or was this just him trying to be relevant to the election discussion?
Specifics, that's right.
Let's go to Mike Bowman.
Yes. Will President Obama's plea for some sense of unity and common purpose take root and have any staying power? I suspect we're going to find out very shortly. I will be back at the Senate first thing in the morning, and I expect that I will be hearing from many different lawmakers on that very topic. But we're already getting a sense. Twitter has been filled with fairly sniping comments from Republicans on virtually all elements of President Obama's speech. They believe that President Obama has been the divisive one for these last 7 years. And I suspect that there will be plenty of Democratic criticisms of Governor Haley's remarks as well.
So let's go back now on the issue of divisiveness and polarization, which exists in almost every aspect of politics in this country, including foreign policy. Maybe we'll go back to Dr. Vedino on the issue of the president's dealing on the Middle East. You know, it's not just about ISIS, obviously. It's about Iran versus Saudi Arabia now, as well as the issues in Yemen. So what do you think, is he making any kind of clear sense in terms of where his foreign policy legacy will be in the Middle East?
Well, I think the general idea of the policy in the Middle East has been that of, to some degree, removing a strong American presence there. I mean, the initial ideas going back 7, 8 years ago was sort of a pivot, where America would, to some degree, leave the Middle East and sort of center its center of gravity more in to the Pacific region. That obviously hasn't really happened because events there have increasingly drawn America back there. The goal, nonetheless, is still stated by President Obama, that when he says we cannot always be there, we cannot always build every single nation. So the attraction of nation building, which has proven itself to be flawed, going back in the Vietnam days and in Iraq in 2004. I think that's, again, sort of a divisive issue. I think you will see more Democrats leaning in that direction, where you see some of even the mainstream candidates in the Republican Party, I'm thinking, for example, of Rubio, that do take a different approach, but argue that the traditional approach of the Bush administration of nation building, of strong American presence there, when we do not have that, we have weakness, we have chaos. So it all depends whether that legacy is going to stick. To be honest, I mean, in the Middle East setting, I don't think we can have a lot of successes for this presidency. The Iran deal, I guess the jury is still out. But I think when it comes to Syria and to the larger region, we leave it. Of course, it's not just the president's fault, but we leave a region which is in turmoil, which is significantly more chaotic than what it was 8 years ago.
Thank you, Dr. Vedino. I'm going to give 1 minute to Elizabeth and then 1 minute to Matt for your closing thoughts.
Elizabeth, what do you think we'll be talking about tomorrow?
Well, honestly, the 2016 election. You know, I mean, this is the president's final State of the Union, but I think all eyes are on that race. We have the Iowa caucus coming up on February 1st, which is proving to be very interesting, both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. And then just 8 short days later, we have the New Hampshire primary, which could also throw some surprises. And so I think that Obama sort of laid that foundation, I think setting it up in terms of leadership, which he touched on several different ways, sets the stage for Hillary Clinton to demonstrate leadership. But it's all eyes on Iowa and New Hampshire.
And Matt Ganney, your thoughts, your final thoughts before we go?
Yeah, I think as we move on to tomorrow, I think Jim summed it up very well. This speech was an attempt by the president to stay relevant, to be up to speed with, what Americans are concerned about now. And what they're concerned about now is 2016 and the upcoming election. They want to move on a little bit. Now, we've got a Republican debate in 2 days that has a very good, high likelihood of attracting more ratings than the speech tonight did. And I would not be surprised if we're talking about Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton and not a lot about President Obama, despite what a nice speech it was.
You may be right.
1 minute from Jim.
Well, I think since we're going to pivot into the election, we've had a two-term president. Usually at the end of two terms, there's a general desire for change. I think what we saw tonight from President Obama was, yes, change, but keep in mind what we've done, and basically sort of setting the stage for change with a Democratic president. I think that was a big part of what he was talking about. Republicans will focus on their differences with the president, on where they disagree, especially on foreign policy, national security. That's where they'll make their argument for change, which could be a powerful one in November of this year.
And we'll be looking at the headlines
tomorrow. We have a whole year to enjoy this election cycle.
But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. Thank you to all of our guests and, of course, to our worldwide audience. We hope you enjoyed this special broadcast.
From all of us here at VOA Studio in Washington, D.C., thank you for joining us for VOA's special coverage of President Obama's last State of the Union. We'll see you next time.